Last week, we were discussing, we had just begun a topic called the Seichel HaPoel, the active intellect. And I told you that we would begin it last week and we would just explain it more correctly or more fully, because this is where we get into the philosopher's understanding of it. And that there is a short explanation of the active intellect in Appendix A in the back of the book as well. But I'll just tell you a couple of little tidbits of information that I think that are important for you to know about the active intellect. I don't think that it's important for this to be stored in your permanent memory in your brain, because it's not something that most Jewish thinkers subscribe to. However, it is something that the Rambam very much felt was an important concept. The Ralbag, Gersonides as well, Rabbi Levi ben Gershom, felt it was an important topic. But it seems that for most Jewish thinkers, this has sort of fallen off the theological wagon of the corpus of Jewish knowledge. But it's just an interesting snapshot of Jewish history, just like a person would tend to, let's say, want to study Aristotle or Plato, even though there is more contemporary philosophy that may actually help, maybe more modern and may actually supplant ancient and medieval philosophy. There's still value in studying certain snapshots of historical attitudes towards certain philosophical ideas. And I think to that end, there's a certain value in trying to understand what people like the Rambam believed was going on in the world and how human beings gained immortality. Now, the reason why I mention the Rambam is because we're up to the philosopher's argument. And in the argument of the philosopher, we're going to see things that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi rejects wholesale. But as those of you who have been coming to the Kuzari classes know, there's a certain dichotomy within Jewish medieval thought between Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi and the Rambam. Whereas Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi rejected philosophy wholesale, the Rambam said we only should reject those parts which are theologically unacceptable. But if there are certain truths that are contained within philosophy, the philosophy of his day, then we should accept those truths and we should see how we can incorporate them within Judaism. And I think I've mentioned in the past, either in this class or the Wednesday night class, is that the Rambam truly believed that many of the statements that were made by the philosophers, both of his time and the ancient philosophers, were actually legitimate Torah. Because he felt that when our sages tell us that there are certain things that are very esoteric concepts that require a lot of preparation in order to delve into, this is a discussion in the Tractate Chagiga, they are referring to philosophical concepts. And that sometimes the philosophers of our day have sort of tapped into that ancient knowledge that was passed down to us from Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai and sometimes garbled the message. But the message is nonetheless an authentic Torah idea. Now, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, as we'll see later on, does subscribe to a very similar theme. He also believes that all of modern science that is accurate and true is attributable back to King Solomon. That ultimately what happened was is that people went to go to see King Solomon, they learned his wisdom, and they transcribed his wisdom and plagiarized it and sort of said that, oh, it's really from us, we made this up, when indeed they had actually gained it from King Solomon's palace. But to the extent, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is more equivocal about sort of trying to distance himself from the philosophy of the day, where he says, you know what, if you see something that's inconsistent with Judaism, don't try and fit a square peg in a round hole. If it doesn't fit, it doesn't fit. And we're not going to try and bother to reconcile the two. Whereas for the Rambam, reconciliation is very important because he feels that philosophy has so many truths contained within it that we should try to pursue it and try to reconcile it as much as possible. When we get to this topic of something called the active intellect, we find that there seems to be, a tremendous amount of acceptance of the topic of the active intellect. The Rambam does discuss the active intellect in the Moreh Nevuchim and the Guide for the Perplexed, and he understands it in the way that Al-Farabi and Avicenna, who were two philosophers in the Islamic world, had understood it as well. It's a topic that goes back to Aristotle, although in the writings of Aristotle himself, it's actually quite vague. And I guess there's one other piece that I need to provide you with, that there are two systems of philosophy that are melded and synthesized and integrated together in this period in which Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is living. One is known as Aristotelianism, which is the writings and teachings of Aristotle, and the other one is known as Neoplatonism, which are some teachings based on the writings of Plato and Plotinus and Porphyries, who was a student of Plotinus. These are all Greek philosophers, but they developed differing ideas, and their projects were different. Aristotle developed the concept of form and matter, that everything that exists in the world is dichotomous, and that it is comprised of either form or matter. And what that means is, this is a very strange concept for our modern thinking, is that if I have a chair, and the chair is made out of a solid substance, let's say it's made out of metal, so then this chair is made up of two things. There's the raw metal that is unformed, and then there is the form that is placed into the metal, and that form is something that is non-physical. It originates in the mind of the artisan who fashioned the chair, and he took the thoughts from his mind, and he, using tools, was able to transfer that form, that sort of completely aphysical concept, and transfers it into matter and transforms something that was unformed into something that is formed. And as a result, Aristotle had this dichotomous view of everything that exists in the universe. You are either the effector or the affected. And so if a person is the beneficiary of knowledge, then in some way I am being affected by some higher power or higher kind of being that provides me with ideas. I, in turn, am able to affect other things within my environment by transferring my ideas into things and people and places that exist in my world. I am an effector, but I am also affected. It's the same dichotomy of form and matter. That form imbues something into matter and shapes it and forms it. And in the same way, the human mind has both the ability to give over form, but it also receives form from something higher than itself. So the earlier interpreters of Aristotle understood that God himself is the being that transfers form or intellect or ideas into the human mind. And the human mind, in turn, transfers those ideas into the physical world. But by the time we get to Al-Farabi in the 9th century, we find that there's a more developed conception of how human beings receive intellect. And that is that, and that is based on the philosophy of Neoplatonism. Neoplatonism is devoted to one single question, and that is, how is it that we get to a world which is so diverse and multitudinous and is comprised of tremendous flaw and physicality and defect, when the originator of this world is a being with the presumption that being is unitary, unflawed, without defect, and completely perfect? How does a world that is so dissimilar to its creator come into existence? The premise of the question in Neoplatonism is that when you see a canvas that has a piece of artwork upon it, then you presume that the artwork is reflective of the very essence of the artist who created it. So if you see a beautiful painting, then you know that the artist is talented. If you see a very flawed and very ugly piece of artwork, so then you assume that the artist is very untalented. So the question, of course, is that we see a world that we live in today, which is filled with defect and flaw. So does that mean that the artisan who created this world is defective and flawed? The presumption is that's impossible, because ultimately the creator is the ultimately perfect being. So there must be a way to get from point A to point B, from the artisan who is dissimilar from his handiwork to the flawed handiwork. And that is what Neoplatonism seeks to explain through through what is known as a series of emanations, or basically intermediary forces that go from the perfect God to the imperfect world. And the reason why this is important for all Jews to know is because ultimately a Neoplatonism has the very same project as the Zohar. The Zohar talks about Sfirot, or emanations from a divine force. You know, there's something called the Eitz Chaim, the Tree of Life, that you can see in these Zoharic illustrations. The Zohar is dedicated to the Neoplatonistic project of trying to explain how man can gain access to God when there are so many layers of separation between man and God. And those layers of separation are known as the Sefirot, the Sefirotic emanations. Why does the Zohar come up with those things? Where do those things come from? It was a universal concept that was not just unique to Jewish thought. It was universal to the world of Neoplatonic philosophy, that there must be some kind of intermediary forces, a series of intermediary forces that exist between God and the human being. Now, as a result, eventually in the Islamic world, developed a theory of 10 emanations, or 10 spheres of emanation that exist from the prime cause, which is what philosophers called God, going down to this world. I don't know why 10 was the theory that was developed, and I don't claim to be an expert on this, but this is at least the explanation as the way it's presented in all of the texts, that there is a series of 10 emanations, which is completely consistent with the Zohar's model of Eser Sefirot, of 10 Sefirot. And the lowest most sphere is the only sphere which the human being normally has any access to. In other words, if you want to gain access to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you will never be able to reach up to the ultimate Ein Sof, to the ultimate infinite being, but you can only actually interface from the Zohar's point of view with one of the emanations of Hashem, and normally the human being only has access to the lowermost emanation, which the Zohar has certain names for and permutations for. But the philosopher's world has a title for that lowest sphere. It is known as either the moon sphere, in other words, that it corresponds to the orbit of the moon, because they view it in a very, very physical sense, that this is the sphere that's some kind of transparent sphere that surrounds the moon, or that surrounds the earth, and the moon is embedded in that orbit, okay? And together with that sphere is contained what's known as an intelligence, which is some kind of sentience that connects in some way with our world. To go back to Aristotle, the earlier interpreters of Aristotle before the integration of Neoplatonism felt that man's mind must be affected or acted upon, and therefore it was acted upon by God. But Neoplatonists said that that's impossible for the human being to have any direct relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore, because there's a series of intermediary forces, the only sentient essence that can affect the human mind is the lowest of those emanations, which is in the moon orbit, and they gave that sentience the title of the active intellect. So that's where we get, and here we are, okay? So if you were able to follow that, now you know that we are now here, living it. We are now back in the 12th century, here with Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, trying to understand the philosopher's understanding of the active intellect. Now, again, it's very important for us not to be so dismissive of this, because we run the risk of being dismissive of Jewish literature as well. Remember, as I mentioned to you, that the Zohar does subscribe to this concept of emanations, this Neoplatonic emanation theory, and that furthermore, one of the projects of the Zohar is to train the human being how to ascend the sulam, how to ascend the ladder, to be able to transcend the lowest emanation of Hashem and to attach himself to the higher emanations. As a matter of fact, the lowest emanation of this series of concentric sefirot that we talk about is the only one that is described by the Zohar as having a feminine attribute. And all of the other higher spheres, which are more similar to the Ein Sof, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, are given an attribute more of the in the masculine. So it shows you that there is a way for the human being to easily conjoin, to more easily conjoin with the lowest emanation. And then, if a person wants to aspire towards the prophetic experience and the even higher than prophetic experience, then he can somehow ascend this ladder in a supernatural way, or ascend the spherot. That's something important to keep in mind. The Rambam identifies the active intellect as being none other than the angel Metatron. Those of you who were in shul for Parshas Bereishis, the day after Simchas Torah, may remember that we discussed the angel Metatron, who is known as the Sar HaOlam, who is known as the angel of the world in Talmudic literature. So the Talmud also acknowledges that there are intermediary forces, angelic forces, angels, however you're going to describe them, that are agents of Hashem who interact with this world. And ultimately, we end up with a mystery about HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself and what his essence truly is. And we conclude that all we can really interface in our own personal lives, and the only thing that the human experience can actually interface with, is a manifestation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he allows to be seen and to be understood and perceived within this world. And so whether you call that the active intellect or the agent intellect, which is also sometimes known by, or whether you know that as the angel Metatron, or whether you know that as the angel Gabriel, as the Islamic world would later describe him as, because Muhammad received his teachings from the angel Gabriel, or whether you understand it with some other name, the bottom line is that this is a reality that we have to contend with. Now, philosophers differed from religious thinkers in one very important sense, and that is that for the philosopher, there is no desire, there is no will that it can be attributed to either God or to the active intellect. These forces, or these sentiences, these entities, operate mechanically. There's something called the prime cause, or God, who operates mechanically by emanating his essence to the physical world through a series of intermediary forces, almost like a radio tower or a radioactive object radiates radiation. And we become the beneficiaries of the radiation of that entity, known as the prime cause. What that radiation is pure intellect. And whenever we find ourselves with epiphanies and with eureka moments, it means that our minds have been affected, have been acted upon, and we are able to achieve knowledge that we would not have been able to achieve on our own. And then we are able to take that eureka knowledge and pass it on to other things in this world, so that the human mind acts as both being the affected and the effector, going back to the Aristotelian dichotomy of form and matter, of the affected and the effector. So basically what we're looking at is the philosophical model over here, which takes any sense of will away from HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the active intellect. These things are just radiating their stuff, their intellect, to the human world. And that's how human beings are able to gain knowledge. Now, what is the benefit of the active intellect? So there are a number of points here. Philosophers believe that the active intellect provides an individual with immortality. The only way for a person to achieve true immortality is to perfect his or her intellect to a certain degree. And once you pass a certain threshold of intellectual growth, then when you die, what remains of you is that developed intellect that you had spent your whole life working towards. And as a result, you become immortal through the ideas that remain on after you die. There is less emphasis on a metaphysical neshama in the writings of philosophy, and more of an emphasis on the concept of your intellect. Now, this creates some controversy, because by the 12th century, you have a philosopher named Averroes, who is an Islamic philosopher, who takes a radical view and says that based upon this idea that immortality is gained through knowledge and through growth of intellect, then really, when a person dies, he loses what's known as individuation. There's no individual entity. You have no individual identity anymore once you die. Basically, all ideas that were developed through the perfection of self sort of coalesce and become one with the active intellect. And this created a big firestorm even within the philosophical community. Because remember that whereas the Islamic world at one stage in history was able to completely divorce religion from philosophy, and basically there were certain Islamic philosophers whose ideas were even heretical to their own faith, and yet they wrote them down anyway, and Averroes was actually persecuted for this belief, because what is immortality? If you don't have any individual sense of self, then what are you? What happens to all of your efforts that you made in your life? Is everyone the same? There's no sense of individual eternity that a person gains for himself or herself. And that's why Thomas Aquinas, who was the great Christian philosopher of the 12th and 13th century, writes very critically of Averroes and says that his position is untenable. So that here you got the Jewish world involved, you got the Islamic world involved, now you got the Christian world involved, and they're all talking about the active intellect. Eventually, the active intellect becomes part of the trash. It's consigned to the trash heap of history because philosophers is completely rejected as a viable model of how the human being gains intellect. But that would come at some point in the 17th century when man starts to realize that intellect resides within himself. But Aquinas really starts the ball rolling, and he says that the more we focus upon this amorphous external entity known as the active intellect, the more that this removes a sense of individuality from the human being, and that's unacceptable from a theological standpoint, and therefore the world of philosophy gravitates away from the active intellect. But that's not going to happen until later. In Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's world, the active intellect is something to be reckoned with, and it's very, very much, it's very popular. It's the accepted theory of knowledge in Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's world. So, with that introduction, we can approach the text, and I promise you that this is as complicated as it gets. We're going to get a lot. It's really the reason, and I apologize for that. I know it's a little bit complex, but in order to understand the philosophical discussion here, you need to just understand a couple of preliminary things, and then we're going to move away from philosophy because Rabbi Yehuda Halevi rejects the philosophical model. But at least we should have a working understanding of what the active intellect is. Okay, so we're on page 52 in the Kuzari. And we need a reader for today. Can we get a volunteer? Volunteer. Please go ahead, Tara. Okay, thank you. Just read aloud. 52 on the top. This is the philosopher speaking, remember.
One who is complete is affected by divine light, which is called the active intellect. His inspired intellect attaches itself so completely to this light that the man and the active intellect are indistinguishable from each other. At this point, all of his limbs are harnessed and focused towards performing only the most perfect acts at the most opportune times and under the most favorable circumstances.
So you understand that the way the philosopher is describing it is that once you reach a level of meditation and perfected intellect, you're sort of taken over. Your body, you're sort of like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, like the active intellect takes over for you and really sort of possesses you and guides your life so that you behave in a certain perfected fashion. You're no longer in control of your faculties. Continue, please.
It is as if all one's faculties are complete pawns of the active intellect, having nothing to do anymore with his primitive, passive, and physically affected intellect. Whereas previously he would vacillate between inspired by the active intellect and doing a good deed and reverting to the dormant physical side of his intellect and sinning, he now does only good. This level is the ultimate anticipated level for the perfect human being. For when one reaches this level, his soul is purified of any doubts, the soul is able to understand all areas of wisdom completely.
So it would follow that a person could have even prophetic knowledge once he's conjoined, once he's achieved conjunction with the the active intellect. You have the knowledge of everything. Your mind is sort of now completely expanded and filled with ideas that are not even your own. It comes from a much, much vaster pool of intellect than just what you've acquired through your own experiences in life. Continue, please.
One soul becomes like an angel, specifically acquiring the lowest level within the class of angels, which grants one a sense of being incorporeal. One is then on the level of the active intellect. The active intellect itself is an angel whose level is just below the angel who oversees the moon. The angels are completely devoid of physicality and have always been this way. They also live eternally, and thus they never have to fear destruction. It therefore follows that anybody who has become one with the active intellect, likewise, never has to fear destruction. It is very comforting to know that one is in the same group as Hermes, Asclepius, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. If one reaches this level, then he and they and everyone else who reaches that level become a single, everlasting unit.
Is it clear now, based on my introduction, what you're saying? So you understand now why I went to this whole mishigas of this introduction, right? Now you can read the text and understand what he's talking about, yeah?
Just because she
does. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Okay. Continue, please.
So continue the philosopher. Becoming close to the Creator, as you put it, is only a figurative term. What you should do is pursue and seek out the true knowledge of all things to the point where your intellect becomes active and no longer passive.
So again, it's impossible to become close to the Creator. That's never going to happen because of this Neoplatonic barrier that exists between the prime cause, who is inaccessible to us in this physically flawed world. The only thing that we can hope to do is to conjoin with the active intellect and attain intellectual perfection. Let me also point out one other very important distinction between the world of philosophy and the world of religion. The philosopher believes that human perfection resides in, and I think we've mentioned this before, human perfection resides in the mind. In other words, that your intellect is that which defines you as being uniquely human, and when you perfect your intellect, you become a perfect human being. What you do with your arms and your legs and the rest of your body is of no consequence. If anything, Plato argued that there's this opposition between the body and the soul, and so really it would be much better if the human mind was just a brain in a petri dish without having to be constrained by the distractions of the physical world. The goal of the human being is to sort of transcend the constraints of the human body and perfect the intellect as much as possible. Curiously enough, the Rambam seems to sort of buy into that idea, at least partially. And the Rambam also feels that intellectual perfection is really the key to attaining immortality as well. He alludes to this point in his Perush HaMishnayos and his Mishnah commentary when he talks about the discussion, when he goes into a discussion of Olam Haba. He does point out that the prerequisite to entry to Olam Haba is the perfection of one's ideas, which is why the Rambam places so much emphasis on what he calls the Shalosha Asar Ikarei Emunah. He says that there are 13 basic ideas that a human being has to have as far as the Jewish faith. Because if you have a misunderstanding about God and the universe, then you will never gain intellectual perfection, because your understanding of reality will be flawed, and you'll never have this immortal conjunction that'll make you one with this external force which will allow you to have immortality. I don't think Rabbi Yehuda Halevi believes that. I don't think Rabbi Yehuda Halevi believes that the key to immortality is intellectual perfection. There's two totally different endeavors. The endeavor of Judaism is Avodas Hashem, is the service of God, and the performance of mitzvot. It's not to perfect one's intellect. And it could very well be that for those who are philosophically inclined, that the objective that God gave us in doing mitzvot was as a means to this intellectual perfection so that we can gain Olam Haba. But for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the performance of the mitzvot is the end unto itself. And intellectual perfection is a nice thing. A person should have proper ideas and harbor proper thoughts when he's serving Hashem. But the objective of life is service of Hashem and the performance of mitzvos, and not intellectual perfection. So you understand that the project of philosophy and the project of Judaism are two totally different things. And so even if you're a philosopher who's also Jewish, in other words, is committed to the, you believe in the concept of the active intellect, understand that for someone who is much more of a traditional thinker, and you still believe in, let's say, the Zohar, and you believe in this, all of these ideas about these emanations, you don't necessarily have to believe that the key to immortality is intellectual perfection. You can believe that I have to attach myself to higher and higher emanations of Hashem, but I do that through purification of deed, even more so than purification of intellect. And that would become, that becomes the prevailing attitude. That's why, you know, when people ask me who won the war of ideas between Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi and the Rambam, it seems that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi won the war of ideas, won the battle of ideas, the debate. Because as we gravitate more and more towards the mystical tradition as the generations advance in Jewish history, we find that there is a metaphysical quality that transcends intellect within the Torah world. And that the performance of mitzvot, while it requires kavanah, while it requires intent, nevertheless, there are certain elements of Jewish observance which the human being will never be able to fully comprehend because of the supernatural nature of the Torah that Hashem gave us. And so therefore, trying to intellectually frame everything that exists within the Torah would not be appropriate from a Halevian point of view, from a mystical, from a Zoharic point of view. Let's just keep that in mind as well as we continue reading The Philosopher. So what does The Philosopher say now about why is it important to observe mitzvahs for the philosopher? Why is it important to lead a virtuous life for the philosopher? It turns out that there's no intrinsic benefit in living a virtuous life for the philosopher. All you need to do is perfect your intellect. So what does he say, therefore? Continue, please.
Attach yourself to the path of the righteous, both in traits and deeds, because this will help you acquire the vision of truth, as well as attachment and resemblance to the active intellect. By emulating the righteous, you will acquire the traits of contentment, humility, and submissiveness to others, as well as all other positive traits. You will also praise and elevate the prime cause in the process.
Continue.
But your objective in doing all this should not be to receive a reward or to avoid retribution, as the prime cause neither rewards nor punishes, but rather to become completely one with the active intellect. By doing so, you will arrive at absolute truth, and thereby you will be able to prescribe the prime cause correctly, and know all things as they really are. These practices, therefore, rectify one's intellect.
The purpose of doing anything virtuous in life is only to perfect your intellect. It's not that there's an intrinsic benefit of doing a mitzvah. And therefore, for the philosopher, what particular religious path you choose really doesn't make a difference. You want to be Christian, be Christian. You want to be a Muslim. It doesn't make a difference as long as you're doing charitable acts with your life. Virtuous acts only help to allow you to channel your thoughts properly, to be able to develop your intellect more and more. And so that's the objective of doing anything virtuous with your life. Is it because when you're involved in self-indulgence, which is the opposite of charity and kindness, self-indulgence is a distraction from your development of your intellect, because if you're constantly focusing on indulging yourself with the pleasures of this world, you're going to forget about intellectual development. So that's the whole objective. It's completely contrary to what Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi feels is the objective of mitzvah performance. Mitzvah performance is an end unto itself, not a means to gaining a perfected intellect. Okay, let's continue. We're on the bottom of page 54 now.
Once you have integrated this philosophy within yourself, you need not concern yourself with which specific dogma, set of rituals, and other actions, and choice of words or language you will follow. If you like, you can even fabricate your own religion, which promotes humility, exalts the prime cause, helps you correct your traits, and does the same for your family members and your fellow countrymen, if you get them to listen to you.
Yeah.
Or you might adopt the intellectually stimulating rituals of the philosophers, but your ultimate objective should be purification of the soul so you can perceive things more accurately.
So notice also that the philosopher is not really concerned about being part of a community either. This is all about me. It's all about what I can accomplish in my life and in my own intellect. the fact that I may be doing something totally different from the guy next door to me, there's no philosophical community per se where we need to all be in sync and doing the same thing. We can just do your own thing, whatever works for you to be able to get you to that point of intellectual perfection, where you can apprehend things as they really are and exalt the prime cause. So do whatever works, you know. Doesn't make a difference what you end up doing. Sounds almost New Age, right? Whatever works for you, man. I mean, everything's cool. You know, it's just that, you know, it's all about connecting with the prime force and becoming one with the world and one with creation. It's all groovy. Okay, so, let's just finish off.
In some nations, seek purification of the heart with whatever method works for you, as long as you understand the principles of wisdom clearly. This is how you will attain your goal, which is to attach yourself to the ethereal entity, the active intellect. In doing so, the active intellect may supply you with prophetic knowledge about the future by showing you authentic images in dreams and visions.
Okay. So we finished that unit, okay? So next time what we're going to be focusing on is the response of the Khazar king and why he feels compelled to reject the attitude of the philosopher. But I just felt, I guess, that I'd sort of push this forward so that we could get through the active intellect for today and we don't have to be bothered by it in the future. The active intellect, I think, is just mentioned in passing at some later point in the Khuzari, but this is really all we need to know about the active intellect for our purposes. We'll take a couple of questions and we'll move on. Yes?
Well, the last statement was about purifying the soul. It's the first time soul was mentioned.
Yeah.
How is active intellect and soul connected from Jewish point of view or from philosophy?
I'm trying to think where we get this word soul.
End of
19. But your ultimate objective is so you should... Zoch Nafshecha, yes. In the Hebrew it says the purification of the soul. Well, the soul, you understand, for the philosopher is the intellect. They're synonymous.
Active intellect is the soul.
No, the active intellect is the disembodied entity that is outside the human being.
Okay,
but our soul is what we would call passive intellect. We purify it to the point where it can completely become one with the active intellect. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So we'll hold it here.